My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. Many of us have experienced the loss of a friend, perhaps someone we've known since childhood. When our life paths have been divergent and communication of those paths are not shared, we might reflect on a missed opportunity to have exchanged these ideas and insights and perhaps grown through that exchange. What would you do if you wanted to reach out and have a conversation or even write a letter to someone no longer in this life? What would you share, and in this sharing, would you find some solace, completion, or even a deeper understanding of the path that you chose? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, best-selling author and Zen teacher Brad Warner, had this very experience. When word reached him that his childhood friend, Marky, had died of cancer at age 48, Brad thought of all the things he never said to his friend and began writing all of the things he wanted to say. Brad Warner is the author of It Came From Beyond Zen, Don't Be a Jerk, and Hardcore Zen. Brad is a Soto Zen teacher as well as a punk bassist, filmmaker, and popular blogger who leads workshops and retreats around the world. In addition to his books, his writings appear in Lion's Roar, Tricycle, Buddha Dharma, and Alternative Press. He lives in Los Angeles, where he's the founder and lead teacher of Angel City Zen Center. His website is hardcorezen.info, and he joins us this evening to discuss his path and his just-published book, Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Brad Warner. Good evening, Brad.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
And thank you so much for joining us. So please share with our listeners your early path and how you first found Zen.
Well, I got into Zen by accident. I was, as you mentioned in the bio, a bass player for a punk rock band called Zero Defects and a student at Kent State University in Ohio. I was interested in philosophy, so I was trying my hand at being a philosophy major because I changed majors a bunch of times, but for one semester or two, I was a philosophy major, and I was a little frustrated that there weren't any classes on Eastern philosophy. Everything was Western philosophy, and the one class I could find that was about anything about Eastern philosophy on the Kent State catalog was a class called Zen Buddhism. So I just signed up and I didn't know anything about Zen Buddhism. I knew a tiny bit about Hinduism because we had lived in Kenya in Africa when I was a kid. And there were a lot of Indians in Kenya. So I had a sort of vague idea about that, but nothing about Buddhism. I took this class and it just really turned my head around. It was very, in a lot of ways, I thought of Zen as being the most punk rock thing I'd ever seen because the punk I got into because it was trying to be truthful and real and question society and authority and all of that stuff. And I thought these Zen guys do that and then take it, you know, a dozen or a thousand steps further and really question themselves. And I was just really interested in it. I started doing Zazen meditation with this teacher named Tim McCarthy, and after doing that and trying to make a living as a musician and things for about 10 years, I took a job in Japan as an English teacher, and from there I ended up getting another job as a guy working for this television and movie production company whose specialty was those Japanese monster movies. The guy who founded the company I worked for invented Godzilla, basically. But the company I worked for didn't have the rights to Godzilla, but we made things that were just basically the same kind of thing. And that got me into Tokyo. So I was in a different city before. And in Tokyo, I met a Japanese Zen teacher named Gudo Nishijima and kept practicing with him for several years until he wanted me to ordain. I didn't have any aspirations to ordain or teach Zen, but he he must have seen something that I couldn't see in myself. And so he wanted me to ordain. He convinced me to do it. So I did it. And I wrote a book about it. And then I wrote several more books about it. And now here we are.
So my next question, you actually answered my next question. I was going to say, was there any mutual exclusivity between a punk bassist and a Zen teacher? And obviously not.
Well, you know, they're definitely not the same thing, but I saw some similarities in approach, if not execution, I suppose. You know, this idea of being totally honest and totally open. I thought the punks were going that direction, but they always kind of stopped short. And I thought the Zen people really took it, you know, to its limits.
Now, I have limited exposure to Zen. I attended several retreats at a Zen monastery in upstate New York many years ago as part of a yoga group that I was a member of, and we did practice some Zazen. But one of the things that I noticed about the Zen practice, and especially about those who were monks and the Roshi, who was the head abbot, was that there seemed to have been a bit of a militaristic aspect to it, and some corporal punishment was involved. Is that something that you experienced also?
Actually, no, but I'm familiar with what you're talking about. The monastic life, especially once the monastery gets to be a certain size, almost has to have a bit of a militaristic bent to it. I mean, you have to have a chain of command and things like that, or else the monastery just falls apart. My teacher never had that big of an organization, neither of the two teachers I studied with, so it never had to go that direction. And both of them rejected the corporal punishment. You're probably thinking of it's called the Kyosaku, which is the stick of teaching, which they sometimes go and whack you on the back with if they think you're not meditating properly. But both of my teachers were against that sort of thing, so they never used it.
And the interesting thing about this experience was that they were very diligent about their Zazen. They were very diligent about a type of jogging they would do around the Zendo early in the morning when they would first get up. And when all the chores were done and everything was done, they had a community area where all the monks sat and they used to watch Star Trek.
That sounds about right. Yeah, it's funny you're calling it jogging, because I think I know the monastery you're talking about, and there's a practice called Kinhin, which you do to break up the sitting, because you can't really sit still that long. So the monks, you know, 100 or 1,000 years ago figured out this other thing that they could do. But some schools of Zen do it very fast, so it would be like jogging. But the one I was part of, we do the Kinhin really slowly. Some people do it so slowly you can't even tell they're moving. You know, they're almost standing in one place.
This was pretty fast Kinhin. Yeah, they were running around pretty fast around the perimeter of the Zendo. So please tell us about Marky Moon and the friendship that you shared.
Well, Marky Moon isn't his real name, but that's written up in the book. But I'm calling him Marky Moon because what actually happened was two people that I had known in since high school, who were both part of the punk scene. They both got cancer and both died within a couple of months of each other, and they were both around. They were in the same grade when I was in high school, so they were close to the same age. One of them I was much closer to than the other because I'd lost touch with one of them, mostly lost touch with him. But the other I'd kept in touch with all, you know, the years, as the years went by. And I was even emailing back and forth with him when he was sick. And I went and visited him during his illness because he was diagnosed about almost 3 years before he died. But, you know, right when they first gave the diagnosis, it was not looking good. He actually lasted longer than they thought he would. But he was a friend. He was part of that scene. We'd shared a house together for a little while, you know, one of these sort of punk rock houses where a bunch of people in bands live. And because I was in a band and he was in a band, and as far as the Zen thing goes, though, most of the people I knew in the old punk scene, I didn't talk to them about my Zen stuff because, you know, I didn't have any desire to be perceived as like that guy who's into Zen. And I found it slightly embarrassing because, you know, Zen by the punks was seen as kind of, you know, the old hippie garbage that we'd all rejected. And, you know, so it was a little bit of that. going on too. But I knew him, and he was a very close friend we shared a lot with, and his death really, it was a big deal for me when he died. So I don't know what else I can how much else I can say without just going into the whole thing of the book, but it was somebody that who knew me from before I was involved in Zen at all. And so trying to write to him about Zen topics in this book, even though he's no longer with us, it was a kind of an interesting way to approach it, because I'm trying to talk to somebody who doesn't even have any interest in Zen, let alone any prior knowledge of it.
Just out of curiosity, within the punk movement, was there any spirituality of any kind?
A few people I knew were into Native American spirituality. And one guy, the lead singer of Zero Defects, the band I was in, he was born into the Quaker religion. And he sometimes did Quaker practices. But by and large, punks mainly rejected religion.
Mm. My guest this evening is Brad Warner. He's the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen, and we'll be back with more of Brad and this fascinating story after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World, with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese. And guess what? Egg rolls showed up. Like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going Om? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Brad Warner, the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. So you had just arrived in Hamburg, Germany, where you were scheduled to give a talk to a group of Zen students when you learned of your friend's passing. How did this news affect you?
Well, I knew it was coming, and I'd been emailing him, as I think I mentioned, and he'd stopped answering. You know, he was usually pretty good about answering any emails I would send him. And when I stopped getting responses, I thought, oh, this is serious. And so somebody who knew him sent me an email that I received when I got to Hamburg. And I just kind of, the first thing I did was I kind of excused myself. I was staying at the apartment of these two women that I'd stayed with before, because when I travel in Europe, I usually can't afford hotels and anything, but people put me up. So I just kind of excused myself, and it was raining, and I walked out, and I found this pizza shop, and I just ordered a slice of pizza and sat in this pizza shop and wrote what became the first chapter of the book. It wasn't intended as a chapter of a book, but I took most of chapter one of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen straight from this diary entry that I'd written, just kind of saying, I'm really sad that you're gone. And it was, I didn't intend to write it as a letter, but it kind of came out that way. And I've known people who died before. In fact, I even wrote another book about that. My mother died a few years ago in 2007, and I made that a big part of this book I wrote called Zen Wrapped in Karma, Dipped in Chocolate. And Marky, the basis for Marky, he was somebody who was very close, and we were very close in age. So, you know, it makes a big difference, you know, when people your own age are dying, and you kind of go, oh my God, you know, not only is it sad that they're dying, but you're getting a little nudge for your own mortality there. And I started thinking about, you know, what am I doing? You know, I'm going out here talking about what Zen people call the great matter of life and death. But, you know, it didn't help save my friend from cancer or anything. So, you know, you start to question all of it. But I ended up thinking, no, this is the right thing to do. This practice is the right thing to do. It's the right response. But, you know, for a little while there, right after it happened, I was kind of questioning that. And that's actually the biggest change that me and the editor made from what was originally in that diary entry to what's in the book, was it was pretty negative, you know. And I remember my editor going, well, if you put this in the chapter one of the book, people are going to be like, we're not going to study Zen. But, you know, that's kind of how I suppose how one feels when something like this happens is all this sort of like, comes out, you know, and you want to just kind of, it takes a little while to get your footing back again.
You were talking about the concept of writing this initial item, this letter. Did you ever have a sense at that point that this would evolve into both the book and a teaching experience?
No, not at all. I wrote that and I put it aside for years. And what ended up happening is I talked my publishers into a book that I was calling provisionally Zen 101, that was going to be kind of a back to basics. We would have changed the title anyway, but a back to basics, a book about Zen practice that would kind of be, you know, real beginner's level stuff. And I got stuck on that and was leafing through the diary for some kind of inspiration, like to remember some story or something that happened. And I happened upon that what I'd written the day that my friend died, and went, oh my God, this is the way to do it. Because there's so much, you know, I did feel like you said in the introduction, like it was a missed opportunity, and there was a lot that I could have said. But on the other hand, I kind of don't regret not saying it. I hate double negatives. Anyway, I guess you know what I mean. But I think I did the right thing by him, because if I'm dying of cancer, I don't want somebody who I knew since I was 14 years old to come in and try to sell me their religion, you know, on my deathbed, because that's obnoxious. And I didn't want to be that guy. So I just tried to be real with him and let him decide what we wanted to talk about. And he knew full well what I'd been studying for the last few years. So, you know, I made some effort to broach certain topics, but it was just hard to get into that sort of thing, you know, given our actual relationship. And so we just ended up kind of sitting on his couch watching bad movies for, you know, a week, which was nice, you know, and it was good to spend that time with him. Mm.
Let's begin with Zen for our listeners who are vaguely familiar with it. What is Zen not?
Well, I usually come down on the side of it's not a religion. There are people who can make a good case for it being a religion that I don't necessarily disagree with, but I don't feel like it's a religion so much as a practice. And it stems from Buddhism. So there was the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago, and he taught a form of meditation to people, and he walked around India and taught whoever wanted to find out about this meditation practice that he did. And after he died, the movement that he started became gradually much more religious, and that sort of religious Buddhism still exists. But about 1,000 years after he died, certain people in India and China started trying to find out what the original Buddhism might have been and stripping away all the religious aspects and the sort of more worshipful things and matters of belief and stuff, and getting back into the meditation. So it's very meditation focused. So in order to be a Zen Buddhist, you have to practice Zazen, which is a kind of seated meditation, which you experienced, where you basically sit and with no goal in mind, try to get into the bare bones of what just existing is all about. So you find out what existence is all about by sitting very still, not reading anything, not listening to anything, just kind of staying there with your own life for, you know, a period of minutes or hours, depending on if you're doing a retreat or not. And and so it's this very strange sort of philosophy and practice that doesn't fit in well with any of the sort of established, even within Buddhism, it's seen as a bit of an anomaly. So it's a different thing.
I remember these retreats and sitting for Zazen and trying to make my legs disappear because the pain was so intense. It takes a while to get used to it, isn't it?
Yeah, sure it does. And yeah, the leg pain is the thing most Westerners have the most trouble with. And I suspect that in Japan, too, these days, it's probably as much of a problem. And it has to do with, you know, we sit on chairs, which we don't realize it, but it kind of forces your legs and your back and everything into this very weird, not very natural position that probably our ancestors hardly ever were in, although we're in it, you know, several hours a day, every day. So, yeah, but the main thing about Zazen, though, is there's different ways to put your legs. The main thing you want to establish is a straight spine so that you're kind of sitting up and unsupported. But it can be painful. The legs can be painful. And just the very fact of trying to stay still for an extended period of time, I think most of us have a lot of trouble with that. So, yeah, it's difficult.
What is the exact definition of Zazen? Is it just sitting meditation? Is that what it means?
That's what it means. That's what the word means. You know, it's two Chinese characters that the Japanese put together, or I think it was put together in China the way it is. But it just means sitting meditation, exactly like you said. But what we do in the school of Zen that I learned in is something called Shikan Taza. And Shikan Taza, it just means just sitting. But I think as English speakers, it's hard to get into it because the word just is a translation of a Japanese word that's represented by a hammer hitting a nail. Mm. So it's like just sitting, you know, it's not like just sitting, you know, if that makes any sense. So you're trying to do the pure act of sitting for its own sake.
Considering the fact that we were given friendly taps on the back with a bamboo stick when we were just sitting, I remember those very distinctly and remember not wanting to experience that at all. Now, the school of Zen that you subscribe to, is it pronounced Soto Zen?
Soto, yeah.
And what are the other aspects of Soto?
Well, main thing is that sitting process practice that is just focused on just sitting. And the Dogen is the guy who's usually cited as the founder of it, and he never claimed to have invented it. He claimed to have brought it back from China, but in China it was a very, at the time that Dogen was alive, it was a very minor sort of movement within the Zen stream. And he was a guy who was a son, the illegitimate son of a kind of a mid-level nobleman in Japan in the medieval times, in the year 1200 is the year he was born. And he lost his father to an assassination, which was what just happened in those days, and his mother died. We don't know quite what she died of, but he was 7 years old when she died. And he almost, a few years into his adolescence, when he was like 12 or 13, he joined a monastery, which was not unprecedented to enter that young, but it was certainly unusual to enter when you were that young, because he was very serious about finding out the true nature of what life was about. And the only thing, Buddhism had been around in Japan for a few hundred years by then, but it was mostly kind of a subject for academic study. I mean, there were temples and things, but there weren't a lot of serious practitioners comparatively. So he ended up going to China to try to find a more pure form of Buddhism, and he found it and brought it back to Japan. So that's the kind of historical. I'm a bit of a history geek, so I don't know if I'm boring everybody by talking.
Thanks for sharing that. That's actually very fascinating. My guest is Brad Warner. He's the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. Brad, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about this work.
Well, the best place to find out about me is my blog, which is hardcorezen.info. So it's .info and not one of the other dots, because that's what we got. So hardcorezen.info has links to my most recent blogs, my YouTube channel, where you can buy the book. And of course, all the online bookstores have it, and normal bookstores have it as well. So, you know, it's out there.
And we always say, support your local bookstore and go in and ask for Brad's book. And if they don't have it, say, get it for me, please. We want to buy from you in the local community. And we'll be back with more of Brad Warner after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
This is OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
On Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Brad Warner. He's the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. You had briefly touched about the difference between Zen and other Buddhist practices. What are some of the concepts of Zen that we need to learn about?
Oh, boy. yeah. Zen is interesting because there's probably more literature on Zen I've heard than any other form of Buddhism, and Buddhism has more literature than any other religion, apparently. I read that somewhere. So there's tons and tons of philosophy, but one of the main things that Zen philosophy says is that it's beyond words and letters, so you can't get it from books and things. But one of the interesting ideas is, for example, this concept of emptiness, which a lot of people get exposed to. And I think some of the first people to get exposed to the idea of emptiness in Zen thought that it was a sort of nihilistic, sort of depressing emptiness, but it's more a sense of kind of freedom. So there's nothing, everything that you think you know, you don't really know. And everything that you think you are, you aren't. Yeah, that's one way of putting this idea of emptiness. And so rather than conceiving of yourself as something, you try to let go of your conceptions.
I also remember that at least at the Zendo that we had attended, they stressed what they called compassion in action. Is that part of your practice also?
Yeah, well, compassion is a big deal in all forms of Buddhism, and yeah, the way I kind of learned it was a kind of intuitive compassion. There are people who try to enact compassion deliberately, but the way both of my teachers put it, compassion is something that arises on its own, and what we're trying to do in the practice is learn to respond to it. Mm-hmm. So you discover that the differences and barriers you believe exist between yourself and others are mostly fictional. And this is one of the things that doing a lot of Zen practice can make clear. You know, initially you're kind of given it as a concept, but I found that sitting for a while, the barriers really do break down, and then you find that the most sensible way to behave in any situation is with compassion, because there's no real difference between yourself and whoever you're interacting with. And so why would you want to hurt yourself? So yeah. You're better off.
And if everyone in the world subscribed to that notion and subscribed to that compassion in action, recognizing that we are the same, that we are one, different world it would be, wouldn't it?
I really think so. And I have this, my teacher, Nishijima Roshi in Japan, used to always describe himself as an optimist. And when I met him, I was I was a total pessimist. But his optimism rubbed off on me. And I really do feel that we are headed in the right direction as humanity. But we keep getting, we keep going down these wrong paths before we pull back to the right one. And part of what I think is nice is that meditation is becoming more popular these days, and more people are getting into it, and more people are starting to at least understand the philosophical proposition of oneness, and that's great.
Now, when we're familiar with Zen, we may think of what's known as the koan, such as what is the sound of one hand clapping. What are these, and how are they used in Zen practice?
Well, it depends on which school you're studying in. So the way Zen was originally presented in the West was mostly by a D.T. Suzuki, who was part of the Rinzai school. And they do the koans as a kind of a problem that the master gives to the student, and the student is supposed to ponder this problem and solve it. In the Soto school of Zen, that's not the way we work with koans. They're usually presented in a public setting as a kind of story that demonstrates a Buddhist logic. My teacher used to be, even in Japan, there are a lot of people who will say that the koan stories are illogical, and they certainly sound illogical, but he would say, no, they demonstrate a different form of logic. And once you are able to kind of get into the form of logic that they're expressing, they really aren't as hard to understand as they initially appear to be. But most of them are just records of conversations and interactions between Zen teachers and students from long ago. Even that sound of one hand clapping, I can't remember the story that surrounds that one, but it's based on a story of a Zen teacher and a student interacting. And I put a bunch of them in the book, because this is my eighth book about Zen, and I realized I hadn't done much with the koans in my other books. I'd done a little bit. And I wanted to get into some of them because some of them had been important to me. They were stories that I heard from both of my teachers, and they were at first incomprehensible, but then ended up being sort of logical to me. And in the book, I run through like a dozen of them and give my own short explanations for each one and what I think it means. So, yeah, that's the koans.
Funny aside, when I had attended these meditation retreats at the Zen Studies Society in Livingston Manor, New York, many years ago, the Roshi would share a story. The Roshi, for those who don't know, is the head abbot or the head monk, would share a story about the property across from where the monastery was Walter Cronkite's aunt's property.
Wow.
And for those who don't know Walter Cronkite, he was the lead anchor on CBS News for many, many years. Uncle Walter, we used to call him when we were kids, when I was a kid, and he was the authority. If you wanted to know the news, you watched Walter. Anyway, so the Roshi had mentioned that he had met Walter Cronkite at one of these parties at his aunt's house, and he had walked up to Walter, and he said, by the way, I'd like to say to you that I love your newscast. And Walter said, wonderful, thank you. Is there anything specific? He says, I don't really care about the news. It's the end of the cast when you say, and that's the way it is. That's my favorite part of your newscast. That's the only thing I listen to. And Walter Cronkite, upset, said, is that so? And the Roshi thought, perfect Zen master. And that's a story he used to share years ago.
So I thought that does sound like... It sounds like one of the koan exchanges a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, one of your letters is entitled Truth versus Buddhism. What does that mean?
Well, I was kind of thinking about the... I got into Buddhism at a time that I wanted to find a way into the truth. And to me, Buddhism in the Zen form is a good way to look into what is actually true. But to me, the truth is bigger than Buddhism. So I am much more interested in truth than I am in Buddhism. And if I really thought there was a better way or a quicker way or a simpler way, I would probably drop the Buddhism. And I wrote that letter as a way to kind of express why I got into this practice, and not as a... People kind of imagine that I was converted to a religion, you know, that I believe in, but that's not really the case. I find this to be a kind of interesting a practice and philosophy to approach something that I think is far beyond, that can't even be encompassed in the practice and philosophy.
You know, this could probably take a lifetime to answer, but what have you found as truth?
Ah, yeah, you're right. It's difficult to answer. I think the answer is the truth is sort of here presenting itself for you at every moment. And some of those koan stories, you know, end with a teacher hitting his student, or sometimes the student hitting his teacher. So there's a lot of sort of Three Stooges aspects to the koan stories. Even one of them, he even has a guy get his nose twisted, just like Mo used to do to Larry, and that is actually one of the ways Zen expresses itself, by saying, you know, you're not going to find a set of words that are going to be an accurate description of reality, but there is a reality that's right there, and sometimes the best way to kind of get through to somebody about that is to do something physical, which is why, you know, they sometimes get their noses twisted. And I think really the main thing I've found is that the world isn't anything like what I thought it was, and I am not anything like what I thought or even now think I am. So there's this kind of a thought, and there's a kind of an ego structure that I have and I use, but it's not me. And there is something else going on in this world of which I am partaking and trying to kind of do my bit in. God, yeah, you're right. It would take a lifetime to...
You know, it's funny. You mentioned the Three Stooges. You have another chapter entitled, I'm Just a Zen Bozo. What's a Zen Bozo?
Well, that's what I did an ordination ceremony. I did actually three different ordination ceremonies, but there's a whole story behind that. But once you're ordained, the question is, are you a monk? Are you a priest? You know, people will ask that. And it doesn't fit well, but what I am in Japanese is called bozu. You know, that's the Japanese word for what I do, and sometimes it's translated as monk, and sometimes it's translated as priest. It just depends on who's translating and why. So I said that always sounded so much like bozo to me, and I sort of sometimes feel like a bit of a bozo for having said yes to doing this ordination, because it's changed my relationship with just about everybody I meet, and sometimes in good ways and sometimes in not so good ways, you know, with weird expectations around it and so forth. But, you know, a Zen monk isn't exactly like a regular monk or a Catholic monk or something like that. And a Zen priest certainly isn't like a Catholic priest. It's something else. And, you know, it's a bozu.
I remember that the name, it was called the Zen, New York Zen Study Society, but I think it was called the Bozu Satsu. Is that correct? Is that the right?
It might be. Bosatsu is a word for Buddha.
Okay.
But there may be another word too. But it's something like that.
I'm going to research it when we take our break because I have to say it correctly, and it's going to bother me if I don't. My guest is Brad Warner. He's the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. We'll be back with more of Brad after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the Om Times Experts program. With Om Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting. A teenager. Learning the lingo.
Today I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying, totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous, as in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will think you're, rad, just the same. To learn more, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Some knowledge belongs to us and us alone. The way our girlfriends walk, talk, touch their hair. Details that only a sister can know about her girls. But what about our other girls? The ones we carry with us every day. Our bond with our sister girls gives life. But knowing your breasts can save it. Go to knowyourgirls.org for the facts you need on breast health. Brought to you by Susan G. Komen and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening, Brad Warner. He's the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. I had mentioned the Zen Study Society in Livingston Manor, New York, and the actual name was the Daibosatsu Zendu Kangoji. And you want me to, just to translate that for the audience?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Daibosatsu just means great Buddha. So Dai is big and Bosatsu is Buddha. And Zendo is a place where you practice Zen. Sometimes it's Zen Dojo. So people are kind of familiar with that word dojo because it comes up in martial arts. Well, it's the same word. So it's, you know, the place where you practice. And Ji is a suffix for temple. So the temple is probably named Kongo, which I don't know what the Kongo part means, but it's probably some sort of Buddhist you know, it could be a lot of things. I don't know what that means.
Well, thank you for taking that on. I appreciate that. So you have another chapter about the Four Noble, and I'm spelling that N-O-B-U-L-L, the Noble Truths. What are the Four Noble Truths?
Well, when Buddha first made his very first talk as the Buddha. He'd had this awakening experience, and when he went to share it with people, he gave the speech, and often the title of that speech is given as the first turning of the wheel or the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths are usually given as all life is suffering, the cause of suffering is desire, the way to end desire, the ending of desire is the way to end suffering, and then the fourth one is the Eightfold Path of that leads to the ending of desire. My own teacher was not really fond of that version of the Four Noble Truths, so what I did in that chapter was try to see if I could bridge the gap between this more standard version and my teacher's version, which he said that it was just four different ways of looking at life. There's an objective view, a subjective view, a view in the form of action and reality itself. And my God, this is really complicated. But it's just basically the idea that action itself is the basic thing that is going on in this world. One of the things I learned from my teacher that might go back to your question in the last segment is that we are not, his way of looking at what a human being was is that a human being wasn't a being who enacted things, but it was action taking place within the universe that, because this action needs to take place, a human being appears in order to make that happen, which is a very weird way of looking at life, but that was his way of expressing it. And that's what he was trying to get to with his version of the Four Noble Truths, because he would say that all life is suffering is a way to get you to look at the fact that even if you're having the greatest time in the world, there is that little undercurrent of dissatisfaction going on with it. But in more conventional terms, you know, all life isn't suffering. You have good times and you know, nice days and whatever. And he also didn't like that idea of getting rid of desire, because you can't really extinguish desire. You're always going to have the desire, at the very least, the desire to breathe. You know, you're not going to get very far without that one. So he wanted to kind of move away from that way of expressing it, and he felt it had been mistranslated for thousands of years, which is a controversial view to take among Buddhists. But he would make a good case for it. So I sort of come down on, you know, I want to present the conventional way of understanding the Four Noble Truths, but I also want to present a different way of looking at them, because I think people do have legitimate objections when they hear the Four Noble Truths as they're normally stated, which is, you know, that life isn't always horrible and desire is sort of necessary for life to carry on, which I think are legitimate objections to that way of looking at it. So just making the joke of the Four Noble Truths is I was sort of thinking of how I would talk to my friend if I was going to try to talk to him about this and you know, not try to sound too holy about the whole thing.
Your approach and your teacher's approach almost sounds Jungian in nature.
Well, there is a bit of that. I don't know how much Nishijima Roshi studied Jung, but my first teacher certainly did. And Jung was interested in a lot of the Buddhist concepts, but unfortunately in his day, they really weren't well articulated in either English or German, which I guess he was a native German speaker. So he got a bit of it wrong, but he was kind of, I think his work is very interesting because he's kind of getting out of the sort of normal materialistic paradigm that was, you know, present in Freud's philosophy. And I think he's an interesting character. It does sound a bit Jungian.
What is the Zen concept of death?
Ooh, boy. Well, you know, people, when a lot of Westerners who get into Buddhism get very attracted by the idea of reincarnation, and you can find some teachings about reincarnation in Buddhism. Dogen, for his part, he's an interesting character when he writes about reincarnation, because on the one hand, he'll write about reincarnation as if it's a real thing that actually happens. And on the other hand, he'll say things like, once a person is dead, they do not return to life again. You know, so you're like, what? What are you talking about, Dogen? So my sense is that, as I said a couple of times, what we imagine ourselves to be is not what we really are. And you know, if you're kind of growing up in America with this kind of very sort of materialistic point of view, you imagine yourself as a sort of a human who has a body, and the body lives for, you know, however many years it lives, and then it dies. the Buddhist way of looking at things is a bit beyond that, that we are sort of a manifestation, all of us are a manifestation of something that is much bigger and wider and more important than ourselves. But we are at once a kind of a manifestation of that something. So death, I sort of have my own theories about death. I think it's probably a sort of a transition from one phase to another in this journey. But I'm also a bit skeptical of my own understanding. So I never take my own understanding of things too seriously. One of the other things that Dogen put forth that I was just reading about recently is this idea of a kshanta, which is this infinitesimally tiny amount of time, that in the snap of a fingers there's 65 of these kshantas that happened. And in that time, the universe appears and disappears 65 times in the snapping of a finger. So the idea of death is that death is happening constantly. You know, in every moment, death is happening faster than you can even keep up with it. And yet something sort of continues on through that and appears to bridge, you know, this line of moments. And yeah, it gets really weird when you get into Buddhism.
Is grief permissible? Did you grieve your friend?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, that's why I ended up, you know, walking around Hamburg in a daze, writing this letter to him. Yes, it's permissible. There's an understanding there's understanding that I have that I don't think things are sort of created or destroyed, including people. And so I feel that in a sense, my friend is still there, but in another sense, I can't talk to him, you know, and I can't see him. And I know that he went through a very hard time at the end of his life, and I really feel bad about that. You know, when somebody close to you has to have that hard of a time with their death, you know, you don't wish that on your worst enemy, as the cliche goes. And so there was a lot of grief, and there still is. You know, he's been gone now, I think we just passed the fifth anniversary of his death. Another friend of mine pointed that out to me recently, and I hadn't realized that was the day. But so the understanding of death is a bit complicated and nuanced. You can't really say something very clear like when you die you do, because then you're just kind of repeating someone else's words and trying to live vicariously in someone else's experience or even their philosophy. And we don't want to do that. We want to kind of have our own experience of it.
It's often said that each time we say goodbye to someone, especially people we care about, love, friends, etc., family, that we do it with a warm heart and good feelings. And if there's anything that's interfering with that relationship, to resolve it at that point before leaving, because we don't know if we'll ever see that person again. What were some of the lessons of your loss of your friend?
Ooh, well, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it sort of, like I said in the earlier part of this interview, I found that initially when he died, I went through this a couple of few hours or days of being very cynical about the whole thing. Like, I don't even know what I'm doing. You know, I'm traveling around Europe telling people about life and death, and there's my friend dying. But on the other hand, it also reaffirmed that there is something useful in what we're doing here. And I really do believe that our lives are not just sort of random. There's a very, you know, it's very popular to kind of think of human life as just being this kind of random occurrence that happened on this planet that doesn't have any significance at all. And a lot of people will say that with such confidence. But I think that's wrong. I think there is a significance to our lives and our interactions with each other. And we ought to treat them very carefully. You know, and try to live an ethical life and try not to squander the opportunities we have for doing some good.
what would you like readers to take away from Letters to a Dead Friend about Zen?
I never know. You know, people ask me variations of that question a lot, and I never know. I feel like I put this out there as a way to try to present Zen to people who probably would not be inclined to go anywhere near it, because I think it's a philosophy and practice that has a lot to offer, and that it's often presented in a way that makes it sound very academic or very intellectual or very difficult. But it's not really that difficult at all. It's extremely straightforward. It's the most straightforward thing in the world if you really get down to it, because you're just trying to sit with who you are and let that be exactly as it is, which is harder than it sounds.
And I leave you with this, Koan. What is the sound of your book flying off the shelves?
it's money.
My guest is Brad Warner. He's the author of Letters to a Dead Friend About Zen. Brad, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
Well, hardcorezen.info is the best place. So Hardcore Zen, which is the name of my first book, and .info because we couldn't get .com. So hardcorezen.info has links to it is my blog, and has links to my YouTube page and where you can buy the book if you want to buy it directly from me. Also, your local bookstore, as you mentioned, they ought to have it. My local bookstore does, which made me happy. So, get it there too.
Thank you so much for joining us. Also, listeners, you know, this was a pretty heavy topic, and we started out talking about Brad's loss of his friend, but there's a lot of humor in this book, and quite frankly, I never thought about Zen and humor going hand in hand, but they actually do. So, Brad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been a good interview.
And thank you so much for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.